My uncle nicknamed me Happy before I was born. Said, I don't care whether it's a girl or a boy, we're going to call it Happy. And, you know, as I said earlier, I was born kind of dumb, and now I'm fat, so I'm fat, dumb, and happy, so I'm perfect.
Okay. Well, I'll call you Colonel Hap because of your service, not only in Vietnam, but service for so long.
Came back in 93, and this is my home, and it's been so good to us, and it's such a great privilege too to be part of the Bryan College Station.
Right.
I did, and I remember the bus dropping me off at Eastgate with two footlockers and carrying one of them 100 yards and carrying the other one 100 yards past that one. It was during between semesters, and you know, of course, back then between semesters, this place was pretty well shut down.
Right.
So I spent the first night in the hospital, the old hospital, in the basement before I went to fish camp the next. Very, very, very distinctly, that the last table you go to when you registered back right. In the old days in Sabisa, and when we got to the last table, the young lady says, do you want Air Force ROTC or Army ROTC? And of course, being somewhat of the traveling that I'd done, I didn't realize that I had to go into ROTC, so I asked her, what's ROTC? And she says, Reserve Officer Training Corps. And I'm standing there kind of trying to decide, and the young man behind me says, in the Army, you got to carry a rifle. In the Air Force, you don't have to carry a rifle. I said, I want to go in the Air Force.
That was an easy decision.
Well, my opportunity there was to get a chance to go to Indiana to march in the competition in Indiana, which is not too far from Ohio, and right. I figured that that would be one of the few ways that I would have an opportunity to go home and see my folks. And I have wonderful folks. They've taught me so much and it's stayed with me my whole life. They're doing very well in Ohio still. I'm really pleased to still have my parents. And so I wanted to try to get there, and I went out for tryouts, and obviously back then there were Corps was much bigger, and we had a lot of kids come out for tryouts. And one night I was visited by, turned out to be upperclassman Bob Medina. And of course I had to whip out and meet him and find out where he was from. And he told me, he said, I wasn't going to make the drill team. And of course I knew he was a previous drill team. He was a sophomore and I was a freshman, but he was wearing a cord. And so I figured, this is my downfall. And he said, well, do you really want to make it? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, why? And I said, because I've learned in the short week that it's really an honor and a privilege to be part of the fish drill team. The nurse at the hospital, when I went over there to weigh in and got on the scales, I was a tad bit light. And she sent me back to Sabisa and said, I want you to eat every box of dry cereal and all the bananas you can eat. So I did do that and went over there. When I came back, she handed me a cup and sent me to the cooler, water cooler, and said, drink it until the water gets hot. I don't mind telling you that I was pretty well bloated from drinking all that, but I actually weighed in 129 pounds, 2 pounds over what I needed to weigh to get my commission.
So you made the weight.
I learned to fire there. Jack Taylor, who ran Texas Automotive at that time, helped me get not only go through FIP there or the flight training program there, but pushed me pretty hard for me to go ahead and get my private license. And I did that at Easterwood. I also, right before I graduated, had the opportunity to get engaged to my wife of 40 years as of December the 27th.
Right. So wife Carol.
My wife Carol, that's correct.
Right, right. And now you're the guy in charge there.
I hate to admit this to all my classmates, but you know, it's not your privilege to take advantage of an upperclassman except for the class directly ahead of you. Mm-hmm. But I had an incident after one night at fish drill team coming back. I was balancing the weapon on my palm of my hand walking back to the dormitory, and this junior at the time, and I was just a freshman, told me to come up to his room and proceeded to put me through the drill. And I kind of avoided him for the rest of the time until right before his graduation. Now, I'm just a sophomore, but I saw him walking up from dorm 12 carrying his laundry. And so I went out in the hall and called for some freshmen and locked my door. And they hung his laundry in the trees. And of course, he's looking around wanting to know who did this. And so I hid, actually, very safely, so he didn't know I had done this. And so I felt really good that I got back at him for what he had done to me when I was a freshman. Until we graduated from T-37s, we marched down to the T-38 hangars and walked into the T-38 flight room, and guess who one of the instructors is? And I went home that night and said, Carol, there's no way that I'm going to graduate from pilot training. And she says, why? And I said, well, because one of the instructors is Marcus Hurley, and I don't think he thinks too much of me. And so all the way through the program, he never, ever made any qualms, or should say, he showed any preference that he even knew me. And guys would ask me, Happy, you were at A&M same time Marcus was. Didn't you know Marcus? Yeah, I knew Marcus and knew of him, but he was an upperclassman. I didn't have anything to do with him. Well, then two days before graduation, I was turning in our distributing our scrapbooks that we had done, our yearbook, and I walked in the flight room, and there's a note up there, Lieutenant Happ, you're scheduled to fly at 1400 that particular day. I knew nothing about it, and of course, I'd already turned in most of my equipment, my G suit, so I borrowed a flight suit, and I was wearing low quarters, I didn't have boots. They were at the house, and I did have my helmet that was still in the helmet room. Got my helmet, rushed back there, and walked in the room, and there stood Marcus in his G suit and his gloves and his helmet, and said, where have you been? We need to get airborne. So we got in a bus, and we rode out there, and he said, just strap in. I'll do the pre-flight. And I said, well, what are we going to do? Why am I flying? He said, well, you need 210 hours to graduate, and you got 209.2. You need 0.8 of an hour. And I said, well, what are we going to do for 18? He said, well, you're going to ride. I'm going to go get proficiency. So I said, okay, great. So I got in the front seat. He got in the back seat. He pulled the tarp over for his hooded takeoff. And we got up to the altitude. And subconsciously, I'm hearing him talking on the radio, but I'm enjoying the view. I never had a chance to look around before. I mean, I could see Dallas in CCK or Ching Chang Kong Air Base in Taiwan. And we would rotate in at 15 days at a time. And that way we weren't really counted as part of being assigned to Vietnam. We were actually outside of Vietnam assigned there. But I did have the opportunity to fly C-130 missions in Vietnam. A lot of resupply and cargo, and what a great tactical airplane. I got to do a few tactical things while I was there. We actually took a combat control team up north of Quang Tri. When I took them into there and came back out, the next time I went back in, it was unbelievable. There must have been 2,000 tents, and it was a reorganization just north of Quang Tri, which is in the very north province of North Vietnam. Then I had the opportunity, which I can't talk a whole lot about, I had the opportunity to fly a classified mission. I did that for almost 10 months, my last 10 months there.
Right. So when we talk about 40 combat missions, those are the ones that count.
Are the ones that I can report.
That you can report.
Yeah,
tell us what you can tell us about your job.
Well, I think the kind of missions that we flew were unmarked aircraft. We had no markings. We flew without any identification. So it ought to give you some idea of some of the places that we had the opportunity to go into. And that's what makes this airplane so great and why I enjoyed the mission so much is it's so versatile and so flexible that you can use it for a lot of different things. And I got a great chance to do that.
Yeah. Were the missions dangerous missions? I mean, were they missions that...
If we'd have been captured or...
Right.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, I mean, thank you for that. Obviously, that's a part that you'll take with you, your whole life, and certainly understand that. I came back from Vietnam. You'd been there for 18, 19 months. You came back in.
I did. I had a great opportunity to be an exchange pilot, and during that time, I got to fly in the Queen's Jubilee and got to fly Queen Elizabeth's. Flew a Rolls Royces more than I had the opportunity to be with her, but flew all over the South Pacific, went to nearly every island in the South Pacific. The Kiwis or the New Zealanders, they use that airplane, again, very, very versatile aircraft. They used it as passenger runs, they would use it for cargo runs, and spent more time away from New Zealand than I did the whole time I was there. It's a beautiful country. Beautiful people. What a great opportunity that both my wife and son and I had to have 2 years in New Zealand.
Yeah, you said you flew nearly 1,100 hours in 19 months. So that's that's an awful lot of flying.
It
you
is.
Got to fly, fly an awful lot of places.
To go anywhere from New Zealand is almost an overnight flight.
Right,
in a 130, yes, sir.
I know we're kind of hopping around with your career, but Dice Air
Force models delivered them to Abilene right before I went to New Zealand, so had a great opportunity to go through maintenance officer school and get my test pilot rating and actually flew test ops.
Right, and in that instruction part of it, you enjoyed also.
I did. I tried to fly with the young new co-pilots because you had a chance to shut down all four engines and stall that aircraft, and they don't get to do that in training, but during test ops and had the opportunity to do that quite often on the full phase flights.
Why don't you tell a story, and then we're going to talk about Antarctica.
To do with flying those test ops and flying with co-pilots, I went to Austin in 93 as Colonel Happ to do a recruiting mission for the Corps, and while I was there, a gentleman came up behind me and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Colonel, are you the John Happ that was a captain in Dias in 73? And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, you scared me to death." Well, it really made me kind of feel bad because I thought I was a better pilot than that. But he said, I said, "How did I scare you?" And he said, "Well, my first flight there was as a co-pilot in these test ops. And you were the test pilot. And you briefed on Friday night about we were going to stall the airplane and shut down all four engines." And he said, "Saturday morning came, and I didn't sleep at all Friday night." He said, "I was scared to death." And it turned out to be, which is now our governor, Governor Perry. So
he was secretary. He was the agriculture commissioner back then. So I guess you see him from time to time.
There's no forecasted weather there. You have to go by trends and how the weather is. And it can be a beautiful sunny day, but if you have 7 knots of wind, you start getting obscuration. At 9 knots of wind, it's partial obscuration. 11 knots of wind, it's a whiteout. You can't see me and you standing this close to each other when it's a whiteout. It's about 18 foot deep to 20 feet deep if the winds pick up, and it'd be sunny above it. But and then that sun causes the refraction and reflection of the light in those ice crystals.
Right. Right. And you learned some ice survival while you were there.
I did.
Also.
I had the opportunity to go through survival twice. Once before I went down, then I took the Australians through, trained a bunch of Australians to start flying down there.
And I was right. When you landed on some of these runways, they were actually floating runways?
Correct. The ice runway, we call it, has to be 116 inches thick, but it's actually out in the bay area away from what land there is. But that it's just the ice shelf, and we go out and land on the runway that's been cut level with a bulldozer, but it's actually more than 116 inches of ice.
You talked about why you were there. Sometimes the whiteouts were so bad that you actually had to follow rope so you wouldn't get lost. You could be 3 feet away from from one of your houses there and
you
not know where
it.
You were.
You wouldn't know it. No, sir. It was the first time down there. I'll never forget it. It was awesome. As far as you could see, everything was white.
Just wow.
As far as you could see.
There's
no depth perception whatsoever. Very, very few shadows. Very obviously no trees, not many buildings, especially close to the runway. So.
John Happ, talk about your family real quick in the last minute that we have. Of course, your wife, Carol. Talk about the rest of your family.
Wife, Carol's a principal in Bryan. I'm so proud of her. She's a Blue Ribbon School twice.
Mm-hmm.
And my son John has his own business in Houston and doing very well. And he's a graduate of 93, or class of 93, and really proud of him. And his wife, Nellie, who's a kind of a TV star in Houston. So, and I have a grandson, Jackson, who I'm very, very proud of. He's 5 years old.
I know, and they're very proud of you, and we're proud of you. Thank you very much for your service. 30 minutes goes awfully quickly. We could do several shows on your service, and thank you very much for joining us, John.
Thank you. What a great opportunity to visit with you.
All right. Thank you. A little wonder that John Happ's passion for flying has landed him in a job that he loves as Director of Aviation at Easterwood Airport. We salute John Happ for his service as an Air Force officer, as a former member of the College Station City Council, and as a very, very valued citizen of the Brazos Valley. I'm Tom Turbeville. Join us next time on Veterans of the Valley.